Coming up today, Google's new human mimicking AI assistant, creepy or cool, and how the next version of Android P is going to try and get you to look at your phone less, a lot less. You're listening to episode 368 of the Wired UK podcast, your essential weekly catch-up on all the big stories in technology, science and business. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me this week are the Matts, Reynolds.
Hello.
And Burgess.
Hello.
This is the week when Google announced a whole bunch of things, from human mimicking AIs to ways to cure your smartphone addiction, as we just mentioned, and we'll have a lot more on that later.
It was also the week when Facebook and Google both moved to limit advertisements around Ireland's upcoming abortion referendum, essentially admitting their platforms can be used to manipulate people's votes. Both of the US tech firms only acted after a load of misinformation had been found.
It was also the week where we found out that the fatal collision between a self-driving Uber car and a pedestrian was caused by a bug in the car's software that meant that it saw the pedestrian carrying a bike, but it didn't react to her presence. This is according to a report in The Information, but despite this, Uber's CEO said earlier this week that the company would resume testing in its self-driving cars in a few months' time.
Getting a bit smoother at that new introduction, I think.
It's really hard to read.
Reading is hard, and we do this all in one take where we can. So you are listening to it live, even though it's pre-recorded. Let's move on to facts. What did you learn this week, Matt Burgess?
This week I learned that the island of South Georgia has declared itself rat-free for the first time in 250 years.
This is a brilliant fact.
And it's, well, it is a fact, but it's also a news story, which most facts are at some point. So, the island of South Georgia is around 100 miles long. It's been plagued by rats for many years. It is home to lots of populations of different animals. I think there are four endangered types of penguins that live there. And there has been a 10-year, decade-long effort to rid the island of rats. It successfully worked, basically involved a lot of rat pellets. Poison. And people have just finished conducting a giant survey of the island and found that there's no more rats there. A team of people, along with three dogs that were called Will, Ahu and Wei, walked across the 1500 square miles of island and found no rats at all over a period of 2 years.
And this is no mean feat, because this is an island completely in the middle of nowhere in the South Atlantic Ocean near the Arctic. It's incredibly, incredibly cold. There's no proper human population other than research scientists. And I think the rats got there on whaling ships a couple of hundred years ago and were causing havoc, because obviously all the birds that go there lay their eggs on the ground and the rats think that's jolly tasty.
Yeah, so basically we introduced the rats, but now after 250 years have got rid of them as well.
Way to go, but also boo. Matt Reynolds?
This week I went to my fact. So I went to an underground grotto in the English seaside town of Margate that is decorated with 4.6 million shells. It was discovered by chance in 1835, but no one really knows why it's there or who made it. So it's underground fantastical world of shells.
How are they all stuck on?
They're stuck on with many different types of concrete type thing, five different types, the museum informed me. And we don't know, some people think that it might have been, you know, a kind of a rich man's folly, or it might have been a kind of like a maybe an ancient temple for worshipping things, but
aliens.
I think definitely aliens.
Definitely aliens. And it's very incongruous because it's on a very unremarkable suburban street in a small British seaside town. There's this fantastical grotto.
Yeah, it's really weird. It was like someone was, you know, excavating a garden, you know, to, I don't know, build something, and they came across this amazing kind of, this amazing shell grotto.
Full of aliens. So I learned this week, here's a question. Why do so many Spanish people say th instead of s? So chorizo.
It's how their language has evolved.
So someone told me an urban legend, which turns out to be absolute bunkum. So the urban legend has it that Peter of Castile, who reigned over the region in the 14th century, had a lisp or a lithp, and this affected his pronunciation. And so everyone started pronouncing things like he did, because it was seen as the done thing. That was the way to speak. But it turns out that the th instead of the s sound didn't develop until the 16th century, long after Peter of Castile's death.
Related question, is it okay, you know, is it cool when people do the kind of like, instead of chorizo, which might make, I think is how most British people probably pronounce it, when they go chorizo, or is that like a bit, you know, is a bit try hard?
Chorizo.
I mean, like paella. I don't know if I like it when people do that, or if I think, oh god, you're trying to, you know, you're showing off, you know, the real pronunciation.
It depends the kind of person that you want to be. Something to think about.
I'm paella, but not chorizo.
Good. Our special offer, which we're still running because it's been so popular. You can get 3 issues of the Mighty Fine Wired magazine for just £1. This is a special offer, especially for podcast listeners. To redeem this once-in-a-lifetime offer that we're continuing to make available, head to wired.uk/podcast offer. Not .co.uk, wired.uk/podcast offer. Don't type in the www. We're going to make this easier. Surely we have to make this easier for people. But so many of you have already taken us up on it. So do head to wired.uk/podcast offer to get 3 issues of Wired magazine for just £1. They're normally about £4 a pop, so you're getting a damn good deal. You can also get access to our digital editions on Android and iOS as part of the deal. Free delivery, and it's only available, I'm afraid, in the UK. All right, that's all the housekeeping over. Let's get into the meaty stuff. This week was all about Google I.O. This is Google's huge tech conference. Matt, give us the headlines.
Okay, so I'm going to run through this as quickly as possible so we can dive into a few more of the controversial issues. So this, as you mentioned, James, is Google I.O. It's its annual developer conference. It takes place in Mountain View, California. It's a 4-day event that is primarily aimed at developers of Android and other Google products. And this is basically showing developers what Google has been working on, what they'll be using in their next versions of Android and other Google-related software. And there's also a big keynote on the first day, on the first evening, which is actually, I think it's morning. Sorry, it's morning in the US, evening here in the UK, where 7,000 people attend, and Google sort of does a big press thing showing off some of its all fancy new things that it's been working on. And I take it you want to know what the big things were.
No, I don't actually. No, I do. So this took place from Tuesday. It's wrapping up today, and as you say, it's primarily for developers, but Google being Google, it can't deny itself the opportunity to make a big song and dance and generate some headlines, which it very successfully did this year with a couple of things.
So Android P, which is the next version of the Android operating system for mobile phones and tablets, we found out some more about it. We don't know its official name yet. We'll find that out sort of later in the year when it's like the final version comes out. Google does this weird thing where it thinks people care about the name of its operating system.
Team Peanut Butter.
I reckon peanut butter as well.
Yep.
Okay, then we're going for that. We might as well just call it that. So the next version is getting a lot more personal. Google is unsurprisingly using a lot more AI. It's going to use AI within its system to sort of use adaptive battery settings. So it's going to learn when you use your phone, how you use it, and sort of adjust the battery settings to make it hopefully more efficient. And there's also going to be sort of predictive actions for the next things that you do. So if you always call somebody at 7 p.m, maybe when it comes around to 7 p.m, the app or the user interface will show the option to call James Templeton, as I do every single evening.
It's lovely.
It's the highlight of my day. Speaking of user interface, there's a lot of new user interface changes that come into the next version of Android P, basically to try and make things simpler. But away from Android P, Google also announced that Gmail will be getting some more updates. It had a really big update, its first sort of design update in about 5 years, 2 weeks ago. But it's also introduced a couple of new features, which are unsurprisingly using AI. So one of these, and the main thing, is expanding its smart reply feature. So effectively, Google is going to start being able to predict what you want to write.
Oh, God.
And then you can just press a button and it will do it. So the example that Google gave, and it probably won't work like this in practice, was like somebody was emailing their friend about tacos and saying, do you want to come for tacos? And they started the email saying, I haven't, and then it sort of predicted, seen you for ages. So that's basically how it works. We'll see how it works in practice. A couple of other things that Google announced. It has announced its Android Things version 1 developer software, which sounds really boring, but it's an Internet of Things versions of Android, which can run on sort of smart home products. It's going to be on Google's first smart home assistants with screens. So basically, like the Google Home and the Alexa, Amazon Echo system, but with the screens that other people are making. So Google's not making these themselves, but this is going to be sort of what's powering the other devices. And these first devices with screens will come out in July later this year. One final thing before we go into a little bit more detail. Google News is getting a big revamp. So the tab on Chrome browser, well, on Google, not just on Chrome, and also its apps are changing quite a lot to try and show people some more balance in stories. So Google has basically recognized that it has an issue with showing people stuff from sort of filter bubbles and things like that, and basically news sources that may not be that diverse. So it's giving people the option to sort of dive deeper into a story by showing lots of different links from one story, and you can sort of go into them and they'll be fact checking and stuff as well.
And breathe. There you go.
I'm done. Yeah.
You did
it. That's
it.
I'm done for the podcast. Yep, I'll goodbye. See you next week.
On the news thing, Google's also been a bit outpaced by Apple. So Apple News, if you've got an iPhone, you probably use it. Maybe people use apps like Feedly and Flipboard, the Reddit app, things like this, ways of the Guardian app here in the UK, or Daily Mail, God forbid. But there's lots and lots of different options for keeping track of what matters to you in the world. And Google kind of doesn't really have one of its own. So it was high time that it kind of gave some polish to Google News and turned it into a proper product. And on the email thing, this sounds awful, because it's just going to mean that loads more people start emails with, "Hi, James, hope you're well."
That's a perfectly fine start to an email.
No,
yeah, that's
isn't.
Fine. Don't what?
It's just, you just it's, straight. You're going to have more of those sort of facile, unnecessarily waffly bits in emails. Just get to the point.
Like sentiment and feeling, and how
it's not. It's not sentiment and feeling if it's written by an AI.
Yeah, actually, that is really interesting, isn't it? Because sometimes I feel bad that sometimes I'm writing an email to a lot of people, I just copy and paste it and then, you know, personalize bits. But actually, is what I'm doing there any different from like what an AI does? Would it be so much worse if it was just the AI that predicted that bit for me?
It's a bad and unnecessary habit that we could just get rid of, right? So email should be straightforward and to the point. No one needs to hope I'm well. No one should send an email on a sunny day telling me, "Hope you're enjoying the good weather," because I work at a desk, so they know I'm not. It's
I
just
hate
pointless.
The good weather.
Exactly. Oh, goodness me. All right.
Your rant aside, I would just like to sum up the whole event as basically being Google showing that it is much more than a search company, which we know anyway, but it's focusing on its AI to sort of personalize all of its services for people to get options that are more recommended for them.
That's Google's new slogan, isn't it?
Maybe a bit catchier.
Google Duplex, which you didn't mention, was the first thing that we wanted to have a bit of a chat about. So this is a system that it's an AI that's been made to sound as human-like as possible. So when you use Google Assistant at the moment, or you use Siri or Cortana, it kind of has that affected, computerized voice. And what Google's done is it sat down and gone, all right, can we make that computer-sounding voice more human by giving it weird ooh-ah intonations and upwards inflections? Like that. And the idea being that rather than having to call a restaurant or, God forbid, fill in an online form to go to a restaurant, an AI could do this for you. And it could do it by calling the restaurant and pretending to be a human. It's called Duplex. And if you haven't heard about it this week, you've probably not been on the internet. So let's have a little listen to it in action.
So how can I help you?
Hi, I'm calling to book a women's haircut for a client. I'm looking for something on May 3rd.
Sure, give me 1 second.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, what time are you looking for around?
At 12 p.m.
We do not have a 12 p.m. available. The closest we have to that is a 1:15.
Do you have anything between 10 a.m. and 12 p.m.?
Depending on what service she would like, what service is she looking for?
Just a woman's haircut for now.
Okay, we have a 10 o'clock.
10 a.m. is fine.
Okay, what's her first name?
The first name is Lisa.
Okay, perfect. So I will see Lisa at 10 o'clock on May 3rd.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Great. Have a great day. Bye.
Creepy?
It's so weird. What kind of like, I think what I see a lot of the reaction around this has been this kind of like strange kind of either people are like, that's really cool from a technological perspective, or people are like, that just creeps me out and that's weird. And I think what gets me is how it sounds so, it goes out of its way to sound human, right? It's all, like you said, all these affectations, all these kind of like, and you know, or going up at the end of questions. And I think that to me, it's really dodgy when you try and have a AI that tricks someone.
Yes, and we should also say that we took that clip out of context a little bit. So Google being Google, and it's rather good at doing these very, very impressive demonstrations on stage. It was a demonstration. So this was pre-recorded. It was done in a controlled-ish environment. and Google doesn't have enough faith in its technology to do a live demonstration of it. And we've seen in the past with things like Google Glass and the Google Pixel Buds, which were at Google I.O. last year, looked great on stage. Wow, we're going to have instant translation between 40-odd languages on the spot, on the fly. It's going to be like, you know, the future now. And then when the technology actually came out a few months later, it turned out to be kind of rubbish. And we've got a similar timescale for this. So Duplex will begin testing in the next few months, and it's the sort of thing that you'll probably have on certain Android phones by the end of the year. There's definitely an element of overhype going on here. But the point that you make, Matt, about it being slightly weird, I think is the thing that got most people excited or concerned.
Yeah, there's definitely two camps to this, I think, and you touched upon it there a second ago, Matt, but it's like people who have seen this in a very sort of technologically minded, basically being like, this is pretty cool. And let's be honest, as a technical achievement, if it works the way that it was demoed to work, or sort of the control demo to work, is very impressive. There's no sort of an denying about that. But when people sort of have sat back and looked at this a little bit further, it's actually like it raises quite a few issues that we don't actually know how this will work in the real world yet. So one of them is obviously like, does the person who is answering this phone call know that it's a human?
Yeah.
Know that it's an AI that they're speaking to.
On the demo, they don't make that clear, and Google didn't really seem to have an answer to that. So it's a weird thing to make this huge announcement, and they must know that this is going to get global press coverage, blanket press coverage. Is going to be hot takes falling out the internet like they're going out of fashion. Google must have known that we're going to be questions about exactly how the system's going to work. And the most obvious one is, so do you know that you're speaking to an AI?
I think that's the amazing thing about this is, so if you watch the video of you know, when they kind of did this demo with the Google CEO Sundar Pichai, like, you know, it was this room full of developers that were like, wow, like, you know, they were kind of, you know, they were loving it, right? And I think that, but like you said, they haven't addressed this major problem, which is, you know, when you kind of like, you know, when the AI does the call, do they say, hey, this is Matt Reynolds' bot or whatever? And I think the fact that Google didn't clarify that really basic point, or perhaps even more worryingly, had assumed that wouldn't be a question that was asked and just thought, well, just do whatever, makes you kind of think, well, how much they've got carried away with their own tech and thinking like, let's just make something as awesome as possible and seamless. And I think that it made me worry that actually they hadn't asked this question themselves. And like you said, they didn't really have a prepared answer.
Yeah, but I do wonder if there's a little bit of people getting overexcited by this. So we were talking a couple of minutes ago about Gmail automatically writing emails for you based on the things that you tend to say. This is kind of like that. And you say that you have pre-prepared emails that replies to people for certain kinds of queries. That's pretty common. You know, you call through to a call center, you know you're talking to a robot, but the robot answers your questions, even though it's a much simpler process. So this is just a further development of that. And I get the feeling that if you were to have a system like this where it goes, you know, ring, 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 and the person picks up the phone and goes, hello, and it goes, hello, I am a Google Duplex artificial intelligence assistant calling on behalf of Matt Reynolds. I would like to make a restaurant appointment, please. The person will go, what the? Hang up. Or it would just get really confusing and a bit weird. So you almost need to believe that you're speaking for a human being to have that human-like interaction, which is the whole point of the system.
Yeah, maybe. Well, I think that, you know, that's kind of like one argument. I think on the other hand, perhaps you need to know that something you're talking to doesn't have human intelligence and is a bot on a kind of set of tracks and, you know, will be looking to respond to stuff. And I think that's a kind of like, that's an ethically open-ended question, right? I don't know if you've listened to the podcast, really good, Sandra, which is about an AI. It's loosely based on Amazon Alexa. It's a kind of fiction podcast about this AI that everyone talks to. And actually, even though this is in the future where technology can do all kind of marvelous things, the AI in that is very much, you know, robotically voiced. And I think that when you do that, and, you know, Alexa has a very, you know, robotic voice, that's a kind of decision that is telling you that this thing is a robot. And that's because perhaps we don't want technology that seems to be duplicitous, that seems to be like leading to mislead, you know,
yeah,
and seems to be getting you to interact in a way that you wouldn't with humans. I think it's just an open question. I'm not sure where I do come down with it on that one.
And as we heard on the clip there, the way that the human being responds on that call, you know, that there were the ums and the ahs and the pauses and the, oh, just hang on a second. We don't need to tell a machine to hang on for a second. It's got all the time in the world, so long as there's not a power cut in the data center or whatever. So the problem here that people have, it seems to be the ums, the ahs, the upwards inflections. It's that it's trying to trick people. Does it need to trick people?
I think that it's really tricky because, like, Google, to its sort of credit, I guess, has said that it is sort of still testing this system. It's still developing it. It doesn't know what sort of final form it will take. So it has not ruled out the message or the AI saying that it is an AI. It's not ruled out taking out the ums and the ahs and the bits that make it human. But it just does seem a little bit like, why? What's the point in this? In terms of like, it can obviously try and do these things automatically when you tell it that you want a restaurant appointment at 8 p.m. at this place. But it does seem that it's a little bit like just trying to solve a problem that isn't necessarily there.
Yeah, and we've seen this a few times with startups that aim to replace mom and pop store bodegas in California with a vending machine, essentially. Now, people replacing things that are actually perfectly adequate with things that are utterly unnecessary and kind of cruel for the people that they either affect or replace. So in this instance, if you're someone working in a service industry, it would be really, really depressing to pick up the phone and spend all day only speaking to AIs. I mean, it's still a transactional conversation if it's between two human beings. I would like to book a hair appointment. I would like to come to your restaurant, two people, 8 o'clock on Wednesday. But, you know, you maybe have a little bit of, you know, there's some value to that human interaction. Whereas if you're just sitting there, you might as well have a robot taking calls from a robot rather than getting a poor human being to answer.
That's presumably the logical conclusion.
But then you don't need the phone system because they can just do it automatically, right? So, again, like you say, it seems like they're trying to solve a problem that doesn't really exist. And I think part of that comes down to these problems being, these solutions being developed in, not echo chambers, but in very restricted environments. As you say, technologically, wow, what a clever thing to do. But in terms of solving an actual problem, not really. I mean, I'll just pick up the phone, speak to someone. I wouldn't consider myself a Luddite, but I don't feel that my time is so precious that I can't fill in an online form on OpenTable or something like that to book a restaurant for myself and some friends. And I think the other thing that's going on here is the hubris of it. So Silicon Valley is really, really addicted to the next big thing, you know, the Jobsian one more thing. And they always have to one-up themselves and show this next impressive development. Whereas they've actually got a lot of big problems that they should be solving right now rather than trying to distract us with a new shiny thing. And I think they haven't really learned their lesson of the last couple of years of people, you know, hitting them on the head a bit and saying, come on, sort out your house before you go and build an extension.
Yeah, I think, you know, going back to your point when you said about, you know, about this being a slightly kind of like echo chamber thing, and I think that this comes from a point of view that sees booking a restaurant thing as a problem, right? It's a chore that's got to be solved. It's something that can be done quicker or automated, then we can kind of like get away with it. And actually, I think maybe that's not the case. Maybe you do want this little bit of human interaction. But, well, firstly, if it is the case, it's just a chore. I think no reason why not just have a full up AI and be honest about it.
Yeah.
But actually, if you want to have human interaction, to have a kind of bot that is kind of human-like, it seems like a poor replacement. So I don't understand why they've gone for this kind of strange middle ground. It's like that thing with, you know, Google Maps. The idea that Google Maps is great to get you the quickest route from A to B, but it's not so good if you want to kind of like take a bit of time, like see what the city is like and, you know, what's the most scenic route. And, you know, there are kind of like answers to that. But I think that it comes from a very Silicon Valley idea that this is a problem. No one wants to have to spend the time doing this. Let's solve it to them, you know, automatically. And actually, that's like an assumption, and that's not, you know, how it is. I had a great call trying to change a flight. You know, actually, what used to be frustrating, but actually I didn't mind it, right? It's okay to talk to people, and sometimes, you know, it's not unpleasant.
Matt Burgess, you're so desperate to make a point, you just threw your podcast notes on the floor.
I know,
go ahead.
I'm enraged. I'm not. But the thing you said there about it being a middle ground could actually be, you could take that from a different perspective as well, because obviously a lot of artificial intelligence researchers, their goal is to create a general purpose AI, an AI that can do anything without being trained, without being taught, without having to be programmed to sort of or complete one single task. And I think that from Google's perspective, this is maybe something that's sort of leading towards that as well, in like a next incremental step where an AI is able to sort of have a conversation with a human, not obviously a conversation, but a very sort of scripted conversation or a conversation with some goals that doesn't necessarily know that it's talking to an AI. And this may never even come out of a research project for all we know, but it could just be for sort of training up the AI on new types of data, on new types of conversations, and actually trying to sort of progress the research towards a general purpose system, which, I mean, yeah, that's fine if they're sort of doing it in there. It never comes out into the real world. If it does come out into the real world, then it needs to answer all these questions about how the system is specifically going to work.
And but that's an absolutely giant leap. You know, you say, say incremental steps. We're maybe talking we're long dead and buried when an artificial general intelligence is maybe a distant possibility. This is an incredibly hard problem to crack. But if you were to try and crack it, the thing you would need is lots of data. And what better way to get data than to have a system where you've got lots of human beings speaking to it all the time? And it'll be interesting to see how well it copes when it is launched, when Google starts trialing this openly. Will it be thrown by someone with a Scottish accent? Well, eventually, well, with a Highland Scottish accent, well, eventually it will learn that accent. It will learn what people from North Wales sound like. It will learn what people from Drogheda in Ireland sound like. It will work all those things out. It will work out the different affectations of speech, the thes in Spanish rather than sir, for example, right? And it will get better at both understanding the sounds of the words and the meanings of the words. And for Google, that's huge. And if you look at Google Photos, this is a great example of where Google's taken something like this. Google Photos, unlimited free storage of, albeit slightly smaller, image file sizes that you've taken on your phone. You can chuck anything you want in there, keep it there forever. And the only trade-off is that Google gets to devour all of your tasty data. So it can work out what's in the images, or not in some cases, and it can work out where those images are taken based on the geotagging. It's building this huge, huge wealth of data, which it can then train its algorithms against. And it's the same thing that will go on here, you imagine. So the answer to the question, what's in it for Google, the answer is always data. No one's paying for this.
But it's different types of data and more granular data. So for instance, when knowing Google knowing how you use your battery on your phone and stuff like that, that is all collecting different sorts of data to what it was collecting previously. And yes, it is sort of making your phone easier to use and more efficient to use as a consumer, but actually there is, it's also getting some benefits from this in it's teaching its machine learning systems how we behave.
So how do you design a system like this? Let's be optimistic and say that this is going to be a good thing, even if we don't think it is. How can Google improve this system to make it acceptable, to make it a good thing?
I think that we need to answer some fundamental questions about how people want to interact with something like this, because I think that at the minute, the assumption is more human is better because we talk normally, right? And if you can translate on that onto another input device, like a computer, it's a kind of like lower barrier for us humans. I think that actually we need to start asking the question, well, maybe you need a little bit of a barrier in order to know that the kind of the context of that interaction has changed, that the thing you're doing is kind of different, these kind of like, you know, obvious bumps. So I feel that actually, I think we need to question the premise that more human is necessarily better, because I think that it could lead to some kind of problems a little bit later down the line. So I think that I have no ideas about how you do this, but I kind of feel like let's not accept the premise that we just do make it more human-like and that's kind of awesome. You know, I think that we need to be thinking, well, in what situations should it be more human-like and what situations shouldn't it be more human-like, and how do you kind of mediate that?
Yeah, adding to that, I would go with a tiny checklist of things that I think that should be done if this system is sort of rolled out into the real world. So one, make sure people who it's speaking to, the humans, know that is they are speaking to an AI. Two, be very open with how it's using the data and how the system works. That's it. That's not a very long list, but there's probably more things.
I mean, it's definitely a checklist. There are two things which make that a list. I mean, I have nothing to add. I think the point about understanding the barriers of the interaction between a human and a machine is super interesting, because otherwise, you know, the slippery slope idea, a few years down the line, a few decades down the line, people are going to be having full-scale conversations with these sort of things, and not understanding that you're speaking to a machine could have a real, real impact. I mean, the transactional thing of making a restaurant reservation, okay, kind of fine, but where we might be going with this kind of technology, eventually, sooner rather than later, someone's going to have to sit down and really think about, well, if we're going to have friends who are AIs, what's that going to do?
Actually, yeah, and I think that's, this is kind of like maybe labouring the point a bit, but like you said, at the minute, if you want to interact with a computer, you need to do it in quite an obvious way, right? You need a tap screen or a keyboard or something. But actually, if we make computer interaction more like human interaction, that means the overhearing that computers can do on us, you know, it becomes way more fluid, right? Like, it means that when I'm interacting with you, I could just as easily be interacting with a computer, because that's the nature of the data that they take in as their, you know, meat and potatoes. It's not typing. And I think that we need to realise that that's kind of the path we're heading down. If everything's conversational, it makes even conversations that aren't directed at humans something that could be interpreted as computer data. And that's not really the case at the moment.
I have a third point for my list.
Go on.
This list is expanding, and I might just keep adding to it every week. But what Google needs to work with regulators as well, and data people that know how these systems should be used, how data is being collected, and how what effect it has on sort of an automated process.
That is a very Matt Burgess list.
It is.
You are incredibly on brand this week. So another thing that Google announced this week, and this links back to something that we were talking about on the podcast a few weeks ago, smartphone addiction. By the way, I'm still unlocking my phone in excess of 100 times a day, although I haven't given the app permission to track which apps I use because I know the answer will be Twitter and Slack. And it will depress me. So Google is also tweaking Android to give users more control over the time that they spend using their devices. Matt Reynolds, you've been taking a little look into this.
Yeah, sure. So this is kind of like a bit of a natural extension of a few kind of like trends we've already seen in in smartphone design recently. So, you know, one quite basic thing, there's going to be a new feature or new thing called wind down, which basically it turns phones apps black and white after a kind of certain time of night. I know on Apple, on iOS, we would have like night shift, so it has that kind of that filter that blocks out blue light, I think. So
yep.
They're kind of doing a step more, and that's not only so it's more comfortable on the eye, but it's kind of a highlight that it's 11 o'clock, maybe you shouldn't still be scrolling Twitter, James. A couple of other things that have changed is that Android's going to kind of like make more... James is trying to lift up the microphone and it keeps falling down in front of me.
It's worked this time.
It has worked. So another thing that's kind of changing is that Android's more actively trying to help people keep on top of how much time they're spending in apps, and also trying to kind of give them a little bit more control over that time they're spending. So there's a thing called Dashboard. It's going to tell people how much time they spend in certain top apps, how many notifications they receive, and how many times they unlock their phone.
We were weirdly prescient with this, weren't we?
I know, we did this 2 weeks. We're like... 2 weeks ago.
Ahead of the curve, but sadly we didn't have the idea to implement it into the world's most popular mobile operating system.
Yeah.
Come on, guys.
Like you said, it's worth saying that actually this is stuff that has been, that if you've downloaded the right apps, you've been able to do for years and years. But it's the fact this has been kind of like put into the Android system itself, which tells us a little bit about how Google's priorities are perhaps changing.
And the difference of it being, as they say, baked in.
Imagine
your phone is a cake. Well, we're now going to bake in some delicious time management...
Raisins.
There you go. They're raisins. And that's huge because most people, even though the kinds of apps that we were talking about a couple of weeks ago have millions of downloads, Android has hundreds of millions of users. So this is huge.
Yeah, there's one thing actually you didn't mention there, Matt, that I thought was quite interesting as well. You can set time limits on apps as well. So you can say that I only want to use emails for 4 hours a day. And, I don't know who would want to set that as their limit, but maybe 1 hour a day on my phone.
More.
And when you reach that limit, well, you'll get warnings as you get closer to it. But also the app will sort of be grayed out on your home screen. So you can still click on it. But basically, they're trying to use that sort of same thing in the wind down, turning it gray, just trying to put it out, put it to the back of your mind, basically.
Yep.
And that's quite nice. And I guess that actually one of the other smaller things they're doing is around notifications, so giving people more control over notifications and sort of extending the do not disturb mode to actually be a bit more focused, and rather than just like block everything out, you can block some things out. So you can block things flashing up on your screen out rather than just not sounds or vibrations.
So rather than being a dopamine inducing slot machine, with all the pings and the flashing lights and the colors and the excitement and the vibrations, whatever, your smartphone will be a dull gray brick if you use it too much. And to me, that sounds kind of stressful in another way, because you'd be very aware of your overuse. But I guess we're not used to being told these sort of things, so maybe over time it will subtly and slowly change our behavior, until someone telling me every day that I unlock my phone more than 100 times probably isn't good. Do it less and you start to feel good because of that, and then eventually you just change your behavior naturally.
Yeah, and the thing that I want, and I'm not quite sure if it goes down to this granular level, is to be able to sort of turn notifications off for an app, say for instance your email, after 6 p.m. or something. When you finish work, you don't get any more notifications on your phone from your email app. You can go into it maybe, but you don't have things flashing up, so you just forget about it over time.
Yeah, and so we were talking about how Google Duplex was a grab for a different kind of data. Everything that Google does is about data. And in another way, this is also all about grabbing a different kind of data, but also about almost training people to use their phones in a different way, or kind of to not use their phones?
Yeah, I think so. So there's kind of like there's a few different ways you can approach this. And on one hand, right, this is Google seemingly doing a good thing, right? We know that smartphone, you know, air quotes, addiction is probably a bad thing. It doesn't make people that happy. So giving people more controls over that is a good thing. But also, if you look at something like Google Assistant and you look at you know, the success of Alexa, I think it's fair to say that we know that in the long run, spending more time staring at a screen is not necessarily the way the tech industry is going, right? So actually, Google, you know, making people a bit more kind of like flexible and saying like, well, we're going to tell you when you're spending too much time looking at this app and kind of change that. It's not necessarily like that defeats the object of, you know, Google. I think that they're probably very interested in making their devices more useful and giving people, ways to use their devices that feel a bit more natural. So if it's a case of, they showcase some really interesting features with maps, like how to help you go the right way. But actually before, when they, you know, we were talking about Pixel Buds, they spoke about, well, how about you have kind of like directions in your ear, right? And I think the point is that there's some ways of delivering information that actually don't require being in apps. And I wonder if part of this is kind of like training people to, you know, reduce their kind of like reliance on that. And you know what? You have to get a Google pair of headphones to make it work.
And eventually I'll just get Slack notifications under my skin.
Yeah, I
feel
think
my,
that's...
like my wrists bubbling.
Yeah, the future is scary.
Yeah. Yep. It's and just that scary.
End of the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. End of the podcast. And one of the things that it does is YouTube. So YouTube is an app that people spend an awful lot of time. When you spend time on it, kind of passively, you're just watching stuff. And one of the big changes they're going to make is that there will be a time limit. As you said, you can set on apps, one of them being YouTube. And this put me in mind of, if you think back to the Nintendo Wii, so that's about, what, 10 years ago, maybe a little more? One of the things that the Wii did, I think when you were playing Wii Sports, was it flashed up, oh, isn't it time to go outside, take a break? And it would have this, you know, full screen takeover of a picture of an open window and some trees and sunshine outside. And of course, yeah, the outside, what? And then you just immediately pressed A and played more Wii Sports bowling. But it's kind of been this idea that's been around for a little while. But again, it being baked into the operating system, baked, is super interesting. And we were talking about this before we started recording. Netflix does it. Netflix asks you, are you still watching?
After 3 episodes, I think it is.
Is that it?
Yeah.
So maybe you've been sat down for 3 hours, you're watching something, and it just wants to check if you're still conscious. But rather than it being, you know, are you okay, maybe you should do something else, you get the feeling that Netflix is doing that either for the accuracy of the data it collects on who watches what, or just to make sure it's not pointlessly using up your internet connection. It's not looking out for you, it's looking out for it.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. And while it's tempting to say that, okay, well, the tech industry is listening to this time well spent movement, is trying to think about ways to kind of, you know, I don't know, make us use our devices in a more useful way, I suspect that actually, well, if you look at the kind of evidence, well, YouTube has spent decades, or, you know, a decade, doing precisely the opposite, right? Recommendations, autoplay videos, all of that stuff is designed to move you, shift you seamlessly onto the next video. It's designed to have you spend more time on the platform. And I think that actually, well, I don't know, maybe I'm just too much of a critic, but I kind of feel like I'm not quite ready to give Google a pat on the back for saying, like, you've taken, like, a tiny step back towards, like you said, this thing that Nintendo Wii had, what, you know, what, like a decade ago?
Yeah,
exactly. And I think that actually, if we look at the trends, these companies have spent so long building in stuff that actually does exactly the kind of opposite. So perhaps this is a little bit of a correction. It's just funny that it took this great media tech storm and the awakening of the anti-tech movement for this to happen. So I hope maybe this is part of a bigger thing, but I'm a bit not that convinced.
I'd give them some credit. I think that it is a big step to take, and it is something that will affect hundreds of millions. Maybe I think Android maybe has 1 billion users or 2 billion users, yep, or something like that. It's the biggest operating system in the world practically. So I think it's a good step for them to do it and make sure that it's in there. I think like one of the next big tech events this year, sort of on the annual cycle of tech releases and stuff, is Apple's own developer conference, which, yep, is in, I think, June or July or something like that. And I'd be amazed if there isn't something like this in the next version of iOS for iPhones and iPads.
Yeah, as a platform operator, you've kind of got to get out ahead of this. This is a feature that people want, but it's also a feature that might be useful for technology companies, Matt, as you were saying, as we move to using different kinds of devices and interacting with them in different ways. And it also goes back to what we were saying a couple of weeks ago about smartphone addiction. Is it presumes that the thing that you're doing on your phone isn't worthwhile, whereas an awful lot of the things you do on your phone are worthwhile. So maybe, just like in the publishing industry, we're very interested in people actually reading our articles, people actually spending time with the stuff that we work on. Maybe those same considerations are now happening at Google, at Apple, at Facebook, at Twitter. They want people to interact in a way that has quality, in a way that has some sort of measurable goodness to it, because ultimately that goodness is what drives revenue for all companies. The time that you spend on a device, if it's time well spent, then that time is monetizable, that time is profitable. Whereas if you're just idly flicking between things and not really engaging with it, then that isn't time well spent. So maybe it's a slight shift to make sure that we spend more quality time with our devices, but also more quality time away from our devices.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, because actually it's interesting to think about, you know, in the industry and thinking about, you know, people that develop apps, that metric, you know, how many minutes a day are people using our app or our service or our platform, that has kind of like guided the industry for a really long time. And actually something like this is perhaps a little bit step away to a more useful metric, which is saying, well, actually, you know, how many of those minutes are used in a kind of like a useful way, which I can only think will be useful for the developers and be useful for the users as well. So hopefully it kind of represents a bit of a wider shift in how they're thinking about, you know, developing things for people.
There we go. We managed about 2 minutes of optimism at the end there. But just to put the pessimism hat back on, then you remember, as you talked on the podcast last week, Facebook announced Facebook Dating. The game of getting people to spend more time on their phones and in apps and in services isn't over yet. There's still an awful lot of competition going on out there. But hopefully, once Android P gets the shiny new feature and people can start using it, we'll start to see a little bit of change, and maybe it will show the way for how other companies might like to behave in the future. There we go. We'll leave it there. That is pretty much everything you need to know about Google I.O. If you feel like you don't know something, then go and check out our coverage online. We'll put it in the podcast notes. A few more changes that we're going to be bringing to the podcast over the few weeks. We're going to bring back the podcast inbox once I've cleared out all of the spam email that we've been getting since it's been inaccessible. We fixed the technical hitch, I'm delighted to say. So podcast.wired.co.uk, don't email it yet, but hopefully by next week we'll have it up and running. Turns out that these things are more complicated than they should be. We'll be improving the show notes, and we'll have some other changes that we'll be making and telling you about in a little while. But for the time being, thanks very much for listening as ever, and we will catch you again next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.